Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with a friend if you find it of interest. Today, my guest is Andy McCarthy. He is a columnist for National Review, also served as assistant attorney for the Southern District of New York. He is someone who you may know from his work as a Fox News contributor, commenting on all manners of legal issues and the like. And he's someone that I wanted to bring in to have a conversation with about the legal fallout and the various things that are going on with this Mar-a-Lago raid, which has taken over the conversation in American politics and certainly serves as something, seems to be something that will be a major topic of discussion politically going forward for the foreseeable future. Andy McCarthy coming up next.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Andy McCarthy, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Ben, great to be with you.
So obviously this raid that's happened at Mar-a-Lago has dominated political discussion and the airwaves over the past several days. And I certainly think that there are a lot of unanswered questions that we just, you know, can speculate on, but don't really know the truth about yet. But I certainly think that when it happened, there was just this initial knee-jerk reaction that I heard from a number of different people, particularly those who were kind of, you know, a little bit at a remove from maybe the day-to-day of politics and of everything that's gone on between Trump and the FBI, expressing total shock that this, something like this would happen to a former president, you know, regardless of their feelings about Trump as an individual. What was your own personal reaction?
Well, I'm not as shocked. I mean, you know, look, it is unprecedented for a search warrant to be executed on the home of a former president. But at the same time, Ben, you know, we're in the context of a lot of discussion about whether former President Trump will be charged. We know that the FBI is, the Justice Department's doing a very aggressive investigation of January 6th. There's been gobs of reporting in the last few months that the focus of the investigation has shifted from the rioters to the White House and the people who were both the president and the people who were giving him advice on this Stop the Steal campaign from Election Day through the day of the riot. So given that we've been having this sort of hypothetical discussion about whether Trump would be charged with a crime, I don't, you know, how shocked can you be that they did a search warrant, which is as surprising and unprecedented as that might be? It's a lot less serious than actually charging him with a crime, which we've already been talking about. So I'm a little surprised, just like everybody else is, just because it seems like every norm we ever relied on has kind of exploded on us. But I don't, you know, I don't think you can be that shocked by it if it's already in your contemplation that the guy could be charged with a crime.
Mm-hmm. The reporting from the Washington Post and the New York Times initially backed up this idea that was kind of rejected by most of the commentators who were asked to respond to it in the moment immediately, and basically said this is about a document dispute. It's not about January 6th. It's a document dispute that's been going on for a while. And, you know, it's something that, you know, isn't about finding something new, et cetera, et cetera. That just doesn't pass the smell test with a lot of people. Are people right to either believe or disbelieve that initial reporting?
Yeah, the problem with the way it's been pitched is that it's kind of a false premise. you know, this idea that it has to be either or, mm-hmm. like you couldn't conceivably both be interested in potential national security information that is in a place where it shouldn't be, and that you wouldn't also exploit the opportunity of having a lawful reason to conduct a search that might yield relevant evidence of something that you're really interested in, which is the January 6th thing. So what I think was wrong about the public discussion was this sense that it had to be one thing or the other, when it could, you know, common sense says it could be both. Mm-hmm. And just I want to be clear, because I think if I could criticize myself for one thing in the coverage, it would be I've used the word pretextual, which I think has a connotation that I didn't necessarily mean to convey. When I've said that I thought the search was pretextual, in the sense that I think the Justice Department is more interested in the January 6th investigation than in whatever national security information and government records may be in Mar-a-Lago. What I mean by that is that they're more interested. I didn't mean to suggest that the search was fraudulent, or that anyone lied to a court, or that they're not interested in getting back classified documents if there are some down there. All I mean by it is you have a situation where it's obvious that they are investigating Trump and the people around Trump for January 6th. I don't think what happened at Mar-a-Lago can be separated or disaggregated from what's gone on the last 6 weeks, where they've done search warrants both before and after the Mar-a-Lago search, and they're issuing grand jury subpoenas that are clearly relevant to people around Trump. I don't think the Mar-a-Lago thing happens in a vacuum. I think it has to be considered in that whole trajectory of evidence collection that the Justice Department is doing. And I continue to think that January 6th is much more important to them than whatever crime they have laid out in the warrant. But mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're not interested in the, you know, I'm not saying the warrant is in any way fraudulent.
Gotcha. I understand what you're saying. It's the old, as you, I mean, you made the comparison in our piece about, you know, that there's a guy who's dealing drugs. You think he might have a weapon. That's there as well, but the drugs enough are the reason to go and search.
Right. Right.
Talk to me about why this investigation is happening under the Department of Justice's IG.
Yeah, that's I think, Ben, that it's they are.
That's
not
weird, isn't it? Doesn't it seem weird?
Well, it not only seems weird. You know, they did a search warrant for Jeffrey Clark, and they did one for John Eastman. It was the same day. It was the end of June. I want to say like June 28, 29, something like that. Yes. So just so people understand, to get a search warrant, you have to have evidence of a crime, and that, you know, probable cause of a crime and probable cause that evidence is likely to be found in the place that you want to search of the crime that you have probable cause for. Justice Department internal regulations are not a predicate to get a search warrant.
Yeah.
You know, so I think they're pretextual there. I'm using that word again. But I think they're using the fact that there is an inspector general inquiry into Jeff Clark's behavior as camouflage for the fact that if they got a search warrant, it wasn't for, you know, some kind of a violation of a Justice Department rule. It had to be for a crime, because that's mm-hmm. the only thing that the search warrant is available for. And I just think yet again, like they do the January 6th business under the cover of, you know, national security information in Mar-a-Lago. I think they're at the point where they don't want to come out and say that Trump is the subject of a criminal investigation, because once they start to get warrants,
yeah,
everybody knows that they've gone to paper and told the court, here's our probable cause of crimes connected to January 6th. And then there's going to be a lot of question about, well, what crimes are you talking about? And what's your evidence that they committed them? And I just think DOJ is not ready to go there yet. So they're they're using these kind of misdirections to avoid it.
Let me take a step back just for our listeners to understand. You know, you have the department, you have inspector generals at these different departments across the across any administration, and they typically are functioning as the watchdogs within those cabinet departments and administrations. They're looking into ethical challenges, into inappropriate behavior, into all manner of different allegations. You know, many of them very serious, some of them more typical and pedestrian in terms of the challenges that they face. IG reports are incredibly valuable in terms of what they come out with. Often they detail, significant problematic behavior that occurs within both, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations. But it's odd to have this very important circumstance be kind of housed underneath the Department of Justice Inspector General, because you're used to them, you know, dealing more with employee behavior and not necessarily stretching their reach out to the point of, you know, as we saw this week, you know, the seizure of a phone from a sitting member of Congress in Scott Perry, someone who handed it over. I was curious, just from your perspective, what would have happened if the member of Congress just refused to do that?
Well, I think part of what would have happened more than likely is he would have been arrested by the FBI. And I do think, Ben, that we have to, there's something, maybe this is the cynic in me, but there's something about the timing of all this that I think is important. They waited to do the search at Mar-a-Lago and they waited to do the search of Perry until Congress was no longer in session, right? They had their Votorama over
your the cynicism is speaking to me, Andy McCarthy. Please continue. Right.
So, but I mean, it would be inappropriate to have the FBI go on Congress's turf without like clearing it with the Speaker of the House and, you know, doing all kinds of respect for separation of powers that you should, that you would have to do in these circumstances. Whereas while they're not in session, you know, they went up to Perry when he was walking on a street in Pennsylvania with his family. So, Congress doesn't have immunity from prosecution. They have speech and debate immunity under the Constitution, which is very narrow, but it doesn't give them immunity from, you know, other or any potential crime.
Of course.
So there's nothing wrong with, you know, you have to, as the Justice Department, as the executive branch, you have to be mindful of the boundaries of separation of powers.
It just seems to me that this could have been, you know, had Perry resisted, this could have been explosive in terms of a legal situation that would follow from that. You know, he could say, it's my personal phone. I'm not handing it over to you. I don't have any obligation to do so, you know, or I dispute the basis of your warrant or, you know, any other kind of complaint. You know, I have private conversations with constituents that I'm not comfortable sharing with you, you know, or any other sort of privacy related concern that he could have.
Yep.
And that would have been a very, you know, contentious, potentially legal confrontation between the Congress and the FBI.
Yeah. I'd say don't think they didn't know that too. I mean, the reports we've seen, it's not like they sent one agent who just tapped him on the shoulder and said, gee, Congressman, would you hand me your phone? There was a bunch of agents there, at least three or four. And they do that not only because you need witnesses in case something does happen, but precisely because something might happen. Mm-hmm. So they knew it as well as you're saying.
So when you view this sort of in total, just given what we know at the moment, who do you think should be most concerned that there is some kind of actual physical paper trail or conversational trail that the DOJ's IG is really latched onto here? And I say that in part because one thing that we know, given just President Trump's tendencies, you know, in office and generally, is that he's someone who, you know, does a lot of these conversations, things that could potentially be used against him, just on the phone. It's audio stuff. He's not a heavy paper trail guy.
Right.
And, you know, even while that might, you know, lead to problems for him, you know, in terms of like tearing something up and throwing it away or, you know, that he shouldn't have, you know, this is the sort of thing that as different issues have cropped up over the course of his presidency and even before and after, you know, those conversations you can't necessarily capture. You know, you'd be dealing with notes or dealing with other things that were that you're potentially trying to find. Who should be the most concerned in this current climate that they are the actual in the crosshairs of the FBI or the DOJ IG's investigation?
Well, I don't really believe it's an IG investigation. I think that's a cover. I mean, you know, Jeff Clark wasn't in the Justice Department for about 17 months at the time that, you know, this IG investigation supposedly opened. And as I understand, if I'm remembering correctly, I know Eastman clerked for Justice Thomas, but I don't think he was ever a Justice Department official. I think he went right into the academy after that. So the thought that they're doing an inspector general investigation of a guy who hasn't been there for 17 months and a member of Congress and another guy who's an academic who was never there, you know, come on.
Yeah.
So I don't really believe it's that. And I think, you know, President Trump is their big kahuna as a subject of the investigation. And I think you're quite right that he's not a guy who, you know, he doesn't do email. He doesn't write, you know, he doesn't go to paper much himself. But because he was president, other people go to paper. So there's a lot of contemporaneous notes. And just to give you an example, Ben, I think the most probably because his state of mind with respect to whether he really believed all the stuff he was saying about a stolen election, because that's so critical if you're going to try to make some kind of a fraud case here. I think the best piece of evidence the Justice Department currently has is this statement he made to the Justice Department officials. I can't remember if it was the acting AG or Daugherty, who was his deputy. But Trump said, you know, they're basically saying, you know, look, we can't throw a switch at the Justice Department and find fraud and overturn an election. And Trump said, I'm not asking you to do that. Just say it was corrupt and leave it to me and the Republican congressman. That's the most damaging statement they have. They have that because Daugherty was taking notes because he was talking to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to find that a lot of people who talk to the president make contemporaneous notes that they can then testify from. So because he's the president, even though he's not a paper guy, there's probably a lot of contemporaneous note taking and conversations that they're looking at. And it's one of these weird investigations, I think, where we all know what happened. Like, it's not one of these things where the challenge for the prosecutor is to prove factually what happened. The challenge here is what's Trump's state of mind. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is, of course, the great unknowable on a very second by second basis. But for him. Yeah. But this is the thing that I think is important on the legal side. And obviously, we're talking about this from the legal perspective as opposed to the political. There's going to be ramifications from this, and how that plays out and the timing that plays out under is something that is still, I think, a mystery for most people who are outside observers. What is your best guess at this juncture about how this investigation is going to proceed? At what point it kind of comes forward in terms of the next shoe to drop and the likelihood that has been, you know, talked about quite a bit of an actual indictment of the former president? What kind of timing and scenario would we be under in all logical anticipation based on your experience?
Well, I think there's probably a big internal discussion going on at the Justice Department now about whether they have a case. And I have to say, I have a bright line in my mind, but I don't think they share my bright line, which obviously I think that's a mistake on their part. We'll have to see how it plays out. My bright line is violence. I think if you can make a violent crime case on January 6th, you know, aiding and abetting the assault on federal officials, seditious conspiracy. I don't think that, by the way, I prosecuted the last successful big seditious conspiracy case in the government. I don't see this as a seditious conspiracy case, but they have seditious conspiracy indictments. If you could make that kind of a violent crime where you're showing someone conspired to use force, then I think that case has to be brought no matter who it's brought against, Trump or anyone else. if you don't have a violent crime, to my mind, it would be a mistake for the Justice Department to bring a case because of two things. Number one, we've already alluded to, which is a very difficult challenge of proving President Trump's state of mind. You know, as I think John Turley said the other day, you can't make a case by saying it's inconceivable that he didn't know. You know, yeah. If he believes there was fraud, then you have to prove his personal state of mind. It's not like what the objective person thinks. And then the other problem with a nonviolent case is I don't see how you make one without criminalizing a loopy legal theory. Because everything that happened was based on Eastman's this idea that he had that under the 12th Amendment and the relevant statutes, like the Electoral Count Act, that you can that the vice president had the unilateral authority not to count votes. And I have to say, if we're now going to turn a frivolous legal theory into a felony, when I was a prosecutor, I could have prosecuted five felonies a day. Because you know, frivolous legal theories are kind of coin of the realm in our practice. So, you know, I'm not saying frivolous legal theories oughtn't be condemned, and I'm not saying they're not reckless in a context like this. But I don't think the criminal law is the remedy here. I think, you know, the problem that we have at the moment is that Trump should have been impeached and convicted 18 months ago, and they did a lousy job on the impeachment. The article of impeachment was slapdash. It didn't match the conduct that was the most objectionable. It made it very easy for the Senate to acquit him, even though the vote was kind of one-sided against him. But I think it would have been much harder if they had done. Basically, the January 6th committee is now doing the impeachment investigation that should have been done 18 months ago and wasn't. Mm-hmm. And what the problem I think people have is, you know, they want accountability for what happened, and they're trying to, you know, they're trying to put the square peg in the round hole. The criminal justice system is not a proxy for impeachment. It's just not a good fit. Yeah. So with all that said, you know, I think their timetable is they have to convince Attorney General Garland that there's more upside than downside to doing like a conspiracy to obstruct the congressional count and a conspiracy to defraud the government in the sense of undermining a fair election. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people pushing back, myself included, but I think Attorney General Barr has said this best, which is if you're going to have the Justice Department bring a crime in a political context, it really ought to be a meat and potatoes crime, one that the public can wrap their brains around and say, yeah, this is a case that needs to be brought, which is why I say violence should be the bright line. Mm-hmm. This is not an area where you want people to be creative, because if they push the envelope here, it really smacks of the Justice Department being used as a political weapon.
So, let's go out on this. You know, the assumption has been on the part of a lot of the president's supporters that you know, if this proceeds, that they will indict the president and then convict him in Washington, D.C., where it's you know, essentially impossible to find a Republican. Should that happen, how conceivable do you think that is? Do you think that that's something that could conceivably happen? And if it does happen, what happens if the former president just basically ignores it, refuses to abide by it, announces that he's running for president anyway, and basically says, we'll sort this out in the courts after I win, or something like that, which I would not put beyond him?
Well, first of all, the court won't be on his schedule, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, he may say after I win, and the judge may say, well, no, you'll be here next week because we'll be having a trial. And that's, you know, unfortunately for the president, you know, he may have a lot of influence over how a campaign looks, but the four corners of a litigation are controlled by the court. So he's not going to have the facility to just say, you know, we'll work this all out after I get elected. Now, he's going to be a difficult defendant if he gets charged, obviously, to control, but you know, that's what judges do. But you're right, he can run for president. I think he not only I mean, there's so much ground we're breaking with this stuff, but he can not only run for president as a defendant, he has a theory under which it may help him that, you know, what the reason you need Trump is precisely because of this, because, you know, the deep state and the big government, this is what they do. And I'm the one who's taking the arrows, but they're really coming for you. This whole thing is about going after Trump supporters. It's not really about me. You know, there's a lot of defenses that are available to him. And in the trial, in the sense of saying that he's a political target, and there's a lot of advantage to him in the campaign of saying that he's being persecuted. At the end of the day, I don't think it helps him. I mean, my own view of it is that the Democrats would like to provoke him into running and Trump voters into making sure he gets nominated. I heard somebody say the other day he should be now nominated by acclamation after the search warrant. God knows what would be if it was two search warrants. But, you know, I think what they would like is he gets nominated and then he gets crushed in the election in November, because I think he'd have a very hard time winning a national election. But, you know, his supporters obviously punch above their weight in the party. So you could easily have a situation where he exploits this and gets himself nominated, and then, you know, he ends up becoming Biden's best chance of being reelected.
Well, it will be very interesting to see this play out. It's obviously, as you say, an era where we are breaking a lot of new ground. Thank you, Andy, for giving us your guidance through this.
Thanks so much, Ben.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. I wanted to give you a little bit of insight into my own reaction to the raid on Mar-a-Lago and what the fallout from it could be. But I wanted to just sort of take a step back, because I think that to a certain extent, we get too caught up in the immediacy of some of these developments without necessarily thinking of their long-term ramifications or the way that they're going to play out for people other than those who are the participants involved. Certainly, I think you're going to see a significant and increased call for the impeachment of removal of Merrick Garland as Attorney General. Rand Paul, the senator, has already said effectively this, and a number of other people have already joined on it, you know, including Representative Scott Perry, who introduced articles of impeachment of Garland before the FBI stopped him and took his phone in Pennsylvania. The thing that is really sticking out to me about all of this is that Garland is someone who almost could have been on the Supreme Court had you not had Mitch McConnell and others in the Senate hold back against his appointment by then President Barack Obama in the waning days of his presidency. It really seems astonishing that someone this partisan and this out of control could ever have reached the Supreme Court level. But it really, you know, gives you a 2020 hindsight into how much the media is willing to spin people as being even-handed, bipartisan, even people who would potentially have a good role on the court. People who could be a moderate and consensus builders, as opposed to what he has turned out to be, which is an absolute partisan hack at the DOJ. Look, the overall perspective on this is obviously that it's enormously beneficial when it comes to President Trump riling up his base of support within the Republican coalition. Those voters who already liked him, or even those voters who didn't like him that much, are going to see him as a martyr, as a victim in this circumstance, someone who's being unfairly targeted in an unprecedented way by the forces that exist in Washington, D.C., the powers that be underneath Joe Biden and the DOJ. But one of the things that I think we all should keep in mind is that this is not necessarily an issue that's going to play when it comes to the November ballot box. Regardless of what you think of the priorities of independent voters, and some of them may care about civil rights and individual rights, they may not like the Department of Justice or the FBI or trust them as entities. The fact is that we know that independent voters tend to vote based on their own pocketbooks, based on the challenges that they're facing from inflation, from rising energy costs, from the ramifications of a presidency that have been really bad for the American economy in most measures. So when it comes time to decide who they're going to vote for in November, they're going to be basing that almost certainly on the things that matter most to them and to their families, not necessarily on their feelings about the FBI targeting former President Trump. So from my perspective, this both boosts President Trump in terms of being someone who you know, could potentially just like soar to the nomination in 2024, setting up a situation that could be very challenging for Republicans come the fall of that year. But in the more immediate sense, it could really shift the way that Republicans are talking going into this 2022 election in ways that I think could be, in the short term, a negative. You really want to be focused on the economy, on the ramifications of Biden's policies, the negatives that have come out of this Democratic leadership over the past year and a half. And I think that to the degree that the shift to talking about the FBI and this raid and other investigations into the 2020 election and into January 6th come to be something that people have to talk about or are forced to sort of concentrate on the campaign trail, that's not something that's going to help them win more independent voters. So ultimately, at the end of the day, I think this is a situation that goes both ways. It both boosts President Trump in terms of his approach to trying to retake the presidency. It hurts Republicans, I think, slightly in terms of the focus issue. But it also, you know, is something that goes to their own voters, is going to increase, you know, to the degree that they need that increase base turnout, and certainly is going to be something that is an energizing force in terms of wanting to push back against the quote unquote deep state and the various law enforcement authorities that so many Republicans feel have been prioritizing partisan concerns over their actual jobs over the past several years. This is not going away as an issue. It is one where Republicans need to have more long-term solutions. Just replacing or impeaching Merrick Garland is not going to solve anything here. The FBI needs to be looked at from top to bottom in terms of an institution that has really gone off the rails and needs to be reformed and adjusted to focus back on what its actual job is supposed to be, which is serving the American people. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.